Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I feel very privileged indeed to be spending this portion of WGTD's morning show with a highly regarded reporter and columnist for the New York Times, Dan Barry. He was part of the investigative team at the Providence Journal back in 1994 that won a Pulitzer Prize for a series of articles about the criminal justice system in Rhode Island. He has written a number of important works ahead of the book which we are going to be talking about today, a book called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. This is a complicated and disturbing story, and I so appreciate the care with which Dan Barry has told this story of something which unfolded in a small town in central Iowa. And it involved what appeared at a glance to be terrible, inhumane working situations for some developmentally disabled adults. And Dan Barry has somehow managed to piece together a story which actually, in a sense, began down in the heart of Texas and unfolded over the course of decades. And in piecing this story together, he's also tried to be very, very careful to not paint too garishly in terms of bad guys and good and evil. It is one of those situations that deserves great care, and it is given by Mr. Barry in the writing of this book. You perhaps have read Bottom of the 33rd, Hope, Redemption, and Baseball's Longest Game, and City Lights, Stories About New York. This book, again, is called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland, published by HarperCollins. Dan Barry, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Greg.
I have to say, by the way, one of the things about this story that sort of leapt out at me is that the primary events in Iowa happened just off State Highway 6, and I spent some of my childhood growing up in a little town of Atlantic, Iowa, which is kind of on the other corner of the state, but 6 miles off of Route 6. So I feel like this story unfolded right down the road from where I spent much of my life, and I know Iowa well. And I think that's part of what gives this story a real sense of immediacy to me, even though I knew nothing about it and have never been to this little town of Adelisa.
Right, and Route 6, as you know, runs from Provincetown, Massachusetts, all the way to California. And I spent a good part of my life along Route 6 in Connecticut at one point.
So tell us, first of all, how you first became aware of this situation in Adelisa, Iowa, and what that situation was as you first discovered it.
Sure. I write a national column for the New York Times, and it's called This Land, and it has me traveling around the country. And so in order to identify stories, I'll read online news accounts from around the country. And I hadn't been in Iowa for quite a while, so I sort of virtually dropped into Iowa at one point 3 or so years ago. And there was a very small news article about this case and a lawsuit that entailed the case. And it was and the article had a few phrases that just blew the top of my head off. 32 men with intellectual disability living in an old schoolhouse in a small Iowa town, working at a turkey processing plant for 35 years and being paid $65 a month plus room and board for 35 years. And there was physical and emotional exploitation, and I knew that I just had to write about this story.
One of the one of the things that impresses me most about your book, and I hope I made this clear in the introduction, is that this is a complicated story that unfolds over the course of decades. And I can't imagine a more difficult challenge for a writer, unless it's maybe trying to unlock some kind of secret from the Renaissance or the Middle Ages or something. But I mean, in terms of a latter day challenge for a writer, for an investigative reporter, it just seems like it had to have been an enormous challenge. Did you have any sense at the outset that this was going to be as challenging as it was? And how did you go about meeting the challenge of unlocking such a complicated story?
You know, it was a challenge, I suppose, but I was so drawn to the story that I was determined to get it right. And what it tells you, in part, is that life is not black and white. You know, there's a lot of gray, and people with good intentions do bad things. And I think that comes out in the book. Also, the protagonists of the book are these men themselves, and all of them have intellectual disability. Some of them are more articulate than others, but when they tell you something, it happened. They're not fabricating. And I found that early on, so it made my challenge a little easier, because if Gene Berg or Willie Levi or any of the other men said, this happened, it did happen. The only curveball there was that the men struggle with the time continuum. If you asked Gene Berg, for example, how long did you work at that turkey plant? He might say, I've been there for 6 months, when in fact it had been 30 years. Mm. Other than that, what they told me was true, and I was able to document it with other interviews and also some documentation that I came across.
Right. Let's maybe talk about one other matter that I think is important, and then we'll unlock a few specifics of the story. This is one of those cases in which, at a glance, it seems like something utterly evil has been done. I mean, an undisputable, inarguable, terrible wrong has been done to these men. And although I don't think you shy away from sort of that harsh reality, you tell this story with much more nuance than that, and in particular try to paint a picture of how a thing could have sprung out of something that had no evil intention. I wonder, right from the start, were you, in a sense, committed to telling this story and every facet of it? I mean, or maybe another way to ask this is, at what point did you start to realize that this story was maybe as morally complex as it turned out to be?
I think fairly early on, I realized that these men were loved by those who were in charge of them for many years, and also they were loved by the townspeople. So the townspeople failed to recognize some of the abuse that occurred in the later years, and though the owners of this company that employed these men declined in their vigilance, at the outset, I think there were good intentions at play here. And so I always kept that in mind. It would be very easy to ascribe evil to someone else in the telling of a story, because we like that kind of a dynamic. But to me, as a writer, I find it much more interesting and much more complex and ultimately much truer to recognize the grayness of the situation and to recognize that people do not always have evil intent. Just bad things happen sometimes.
Right. A last question, kind of overarching. I am impressed by the fact that you were able to track down so many people involved in one way or another with this story. And I should think some were probably harder to track down than others. And in some cases, it might have been tricky to even know about somebody who figured in maybe some significant yet tangential way in this story. Just how difficult was that for you to ultimately connect with as many people as you did beyond the actual men themselves and people actually, you know, working currently for this company? I mean, you went back in history over the course of the decades and connected with some people. How difficult was it to manage to do that?
You know, in some cases, it was very difficult. There was one woman in particular who had worked with these men early on, and she was a very important person in their lives. And then she had disappeared. And so it took me a long time to track her down, and I finally found that she was living in South Carolina.
So this is Terry Sen that we'll talk about a little later, but yes.
That's right. And so I sent her letters. I tried to reach her on Facebook, and I didn't get any response. And so I finally went to South Carolina and wrote a handwritten note to her and left it at her place of employment. And I was really pleading with her to talk to me because I knew how much the men loved her back in the day, and I knew that she could help me with a certain part of the story. And I left it at the at her office, really not expecting to hear from her. And I think I heard from her within a half an hour, and she agreed readily to meet me. And that, to me, was really, really rewarding because of the story she had to tell. But that's an example of the lengths to which I went to try and track down people central to the story.
We're speaking with Dan Barry from the New York Times, talking about his most recent book called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland. Although the story, as you discovered it, was playing out in this little town in Iowa, the story ultimately begins decades earlier down in the heart of Texas. And you are able to track down at least some of the people involved with the roots of this story.
Right.
Down in Goldthwaite, Texas, where you meet a now elderly man by the name of Kenneth Henry. Tell us his role in sort of the gestation of this story.
Sure. The story begins back in the mid to late 1960s. The state of Texas has institutions called, they used to be called state schools, and these state schools were residences for people with intellectual disability. And so the people who ran those institutions wanted to clear out some of the beds. And also it was at a time when the country was realizing that people with intellectual disability belonged in the community. They belonged among us. They shouldn't be segregated. And so this movement was taking place around the country. Texas was a little slower than other states, but certainly this was on the minds of state officials. Meanwhile, ranchers needed ranch hands. There had been some changes in some laws, and they were no longer able to use laborers who were coming up from Mexico through a relationship between Mexico and the United States at the time. That arrangement ended, so now all these ranches were short of ranch hands. And so a deal was struck between one rancher and his partner. The rancher's name was T.H. Johnson, and his partner was Kenneth Henry, the man you just referred to, and the state institutions to supply men to the ranch in kind of a pilot program. So the men would be out of the institutions, which was good. They would learn a skill, which was good. And they would also learn other life skills. That was the plan. And it seemed to work pretty well in the beginning, so much so that T.H. Johnson was given an award by a national association that represented the rights of people with disability at the time. This is like in the late 1960s.
I want to just interrupt for one second. One interesting point you make when this arrangement is first brokered, you talk about how this school, the Abilene State School, reached out to, I think you tell us, maybe five different ranchers with this proposal, and this T.H. Johnson is the only one who gives it a try. You write, all but one rancher declined the offer, seeing little more than headache and risk in trying to train, feed, and house men with IQs between 35 and 70. Only T.H. Johnson said he would give it a go. I think that it's worth mentioning because I think it says something about who he was.
Right. And so it seems that certainly he had a need. He had a need for help on his ranch, but he also recognized an opportunity for these men. I think he recognized an opportunity to do something good. And so these men go to T.H.'s ranch, and the skill they learn is pretty elemental. It's really just to catch turkeys. And the men become quite good at it, and they're living in a bunkhouse on the Goldthwaite Ranch, and they seem to be having a good life. The skills are pretty limited that they're being taught, but it's better than the institutions, that's for sure. Then T.H. Johnson and his partner, Kenneth Henry, say, why don't we farm these guys out? Why don't we subcontract groups of these men that we've trained to turkey processing plants around the country? Because turkey processing plants have a hard time keeping their employees because it's a very, very difficult workplace. The job is dirty, bloody, hard. And so that's what they did. They sent a group of men to a turkey processing plant in Illinois, another one to South Carolina, and they sent a group of men, the men who are written about in this book, to Adelissa, Iowa, so that they could work in a nearby turkey processing plant. And so T.H. and Kenneth Henry found an old schoolhouse. It was abandoned, effectively, and they rented out the old schoolhouse in the town. They turned it into a dormitory. It had nice televisions and some exercise equipment, and they moved a bunch of men into this schoolhouse. And then beginning in 1974, starting at around 3:30 or so in the morning, the men would be woken up. They'd be given a quick breakfast, and then they would be trucked over to the turkey processing plant. And at the turkey processing plant, I have to say, they had the worst jobs in a difficult work environment. Their jobs were to unload the live turkeys from the crates on the trucks, hang them upside down on shackles, and then after the turkeys had been stunned and killed, these men had the difficult job of eviscerating the turkeys. And that's what they did from 5 o'clock in the morning until mid-afternoon, 5 days a week, for about 35 years.
Mm. And you describe in some detail certain aspects of that work, and we're reminded that turkeys are sizable birds, they are strong, and they aren't happy about anything that's being done to them. And so it is just physically difficult work, and disgusting mm-hmm. to boot in many mm-hmm. many respects, and mm-hmm. And it's the kind of work that very few of us would ever want to do in our worst nightmare.
That's right. Imagine reaching into a small crate and grabbing hold of a 50-pound turkey, and that turkey doesn't want to be touched, and its wings are very, very powerful, and it has talons and everything like that, and your job is to grab them, and you have to grab them in a certain way. You have to grab their legs and then flip them upside down and sort of tuck them under your arm so that you can keep their wings at bay, and then you hang them on the shackles. That's what these men had to do for a long while.
You also mentioned the fact that when they began work at that plant in Iowa, they were not exactly welcomed with open arms by their coworkers, subject to pranks and so on, and that got to be a pretty difficult situation.
Right, and so some of the other employees, not everybody, but some of the other non-disabled employees made fun of the men, called them bad names, including the R word, which was used a lot of the time, retarded. It was a pejorative. It became a pejorative. And they would throw turkey slime and other stuff at the men. And the men's supervisor said, okay, that's it, and he rounded up all the men, and he put them back in the vans to head back to the bunkhouse. And he told the turkey plant operators, my men aren't going to work under these conditions. And soon things were smoothed out. And from then on, the men had a fairly good arrangement with the workplace, notwithstanding how difficult and how bloody the job was.
You tell us that one of the ways in which these men actually began to be seen by the community, because they were scarcely even glanced by the typical citizen of this little town, but was when some kind of Christmas open house was organized. Tell us about that, why that happened, and what kind of a difference it made in how these men came to be viewed and how they felt about themselves in this community.
Sure. So this is 1974, 1975, and Adelissa had maybe 200 residents. And suddenly their population goes up to 250 or so, and that spike is all men with intellectual disability living in this old schoolhouse on the hill. So there's a lot of mystery and distrust about what's going on there. And so T.H. Johnson recognized this, and so what he did was he invited the town into the schoolhouse, into the bunkhouse, for a Christmas party so that it would dispel some misperceptions, perhaps. And the townspeople were quite impressed because the place seemed clean, the men seemed happy, and it seemed like a good arrangement. And they had these parties for a few years, and then they stopped abruptly. And what happened was the townspeople kept in their mind this positive memory of the operations inside the schoolhouse, and that became problematic as the situation inside the bunkhouse declined. The schoolhouse became squalid, it became cockroach-infested, and the men were being emotionally and physically abused. But on the outside, the schoolhouse looked, we know what's going on in there, it's fine. And so the people never inquired further. They assumed that everything was all right inside the walls of that place.
It's almost an echo of the Terezin Nazi camp, which was, of course, designed to put forth the most positive public face of what these camps were like, trying to hide a worse truth. Although what you're describing is something that at one point actually was fairly close to what was being presented to the public. And once that reality changed, the public never realized that reality had in fact changed.
That's right. Except there were tip-offs. I mean, the schoolhouse windows were boarded up after a while. And so here you have a schoolhouse on the hill of your small town, and those windows are boarded up suddenly. And now and then you'll see a padlock on the front door. And so in one respect, the garden is very well kept and it looks neat and clean. But on the other hand, there are these little hints that things are not quite right. And those hints were missed.
Right. By the way, another positive stream of the story is when you tell us about the pastor there at Zion Lutheran Church, John Beck, who was very interested in inclusivity and ended up welcoming these men into the fold of that congregation, and even a small little choir is created. That is something I did not expect to see in this book.
Yeah, it's a quite affecting moment. John Beck is a new minister in this small town at the Zion Lutheran Church, and he notices these men with intellectual disability walking the streets. They would go to the mini mart and they would go to the post office. And he saw an opportunity for inclusivity, not only to benefit the men, but also to benefit his own congregation in opening their eyes to the varied world that's out there. And so he invited the men in, and they just prospered. They just loved being a part of this community. And they created their own Henry's Boys Choir. That's what it was called. The operation was called Henry's Turkey Service. And these men were called boys, even though they were in their 20s, 30s, and 40s at the time. And so they created the Henry's Boys Choir in this church. And they became very much an integral part of that congregation.
Mm-hmm. There's a really poignant photograph of them dressed up as clowns, I think, on their way to the county fair, where they're going to perform or something, and we are seeing a snapshot of happier days. This is maybe a good time for us to mention someone who you mentioned earlier in the interview, Terry Sen, a woman who had worked with some of these boys in the factory. And she was involved in what turned out to be a very unhappy incident. But she very clearly cared about them. And one of the things you describe in telling her story is how this is somebody who was given essentially not an iota of special training. in how to work with developmentally disabled adults, and yet she managed to do the best she could. It's a really moving story.
Well, it's one of the problems of the Henry's Turkey Service model. I mean, there are many, many problems with this operation. But one is that you have a house filled with 40 or 50 men with intellectual disability. They all have needs. They all have they need attention. And so Henry's Turkey Service never trained anybody in how to work with people with disability. They never took advantage of the opportunities and the programs that were available in that county for people with disability. And so what happened was they just took pretty much anyone off the street who needed a job and said, okay, you're in charge of these men. And it wasn't that simple. And so Terry Senn is a big-hearted woman, and she was drawn to people with disability, wanting to help them. And she had no real training. She just went by her instincts. And what happened was at one point, one of the men named Alfred Busby did something improper at the plant. And so they came home at the end of the day, and Terry Senn's supervisor said, you have to punish Alfred. He has to be disciplined. She was reluctant to do it. She was like 21 or so, and Alfred Busby is in his late 30s. And we have to remember that these men are men. They're not boys. And so she called them into an office, and she said, Alfred, you're not allowed to watch television tonight, and after dinner, you have to go right to your room. Now, in retrospect, Terry Senn will tell you, I should never have talked to a grown man that way. You would never do that. But that was the time, and that was the ethos inside this building. And so she disciplines Alfred Busby. He's mortified. He's not allowed to watch television, and he has to go to his room. And so the next morning, when Terry Senn and the rest of the house woke up, they learned that Alfred Busby had disappeared. He had run away. And he wasn't the first man to run away, but he had run away. And the problem was that this was January in Iowa, and so it was 0 degrees outside. And he disappeared, and they had a search party. They had helicopters. They couldn't find Alfred Busby. And so Terry Senn convinced herself that Alfred Busby had simply hitchhiked his way back to Texas from Iowa. It was the only way that she could process and accept what had happened. And unfortunately, 3 or 4 months later, during the spring thaw, a farmer went out into his fields and he was checking the rows and everything. And here he sees what looks like a scarecrow, but it was Alfred Busby. He had died that day. And so Terry Senn, to this day, feels great remorse and great regret, yet she has turned it into something positive in that she has trained other people who work with people with disability. And she always tells the story about herself and about Alfred Busby. And she always says, you never, ever, ever, ever speak to your charge this way. You never speak to the man or woman this way. You treat them with respect that they deserve.
Mm-hmm. I also appreciate the story of a social worker by the name of Ed George, just 24 years old. So practically still a child himself in some respects. I mean, very inexperienced. But when some points of great concern are brought to his attention, he actually sits down and writes an extensive letter, which you quote in its, I believe, in its entirety, spelling out his concerns about what he has seen. And and unfortunately, it generates, you know, nothing like the outrage that he was expecting, and next to nothing actually ends up being changed. And you tell us that as he looks back on that, and that's back in 1974, all of these years later, you say most of all, he remembers the hollowed-out feeling of helplessness. Those are really chilling words. And
Well, you know, Ed George writes this letter. He's a social worker for the state of Iowa, and Henry's Turkey Service moves up to Iowa and takes residence in that bunkhouse. Okay, and so there's an aura of feel goodness about it. But Ed George recognizes why this is not a good situation. very early on. I mean, Kenreach Turkey Services in Iowa, only for a few months, when Ed George visits the operation, and he sits down and writes this scathing memorandum to his supervisors saying this operation is virtual servitude. This is virtual slavery. These men are being denied basic rights. They're not being allowed to say whether they want to work at the turkey plant or whether they want to live in the bunkhouse. They have no rights whatsoever, and they're being paid well below minimum wage. This is exploitation of the first order. We should not be fooled. And that's what he wrote in this memorandum in 1974. And that memorandum immediately went to the wastebasket. And everything that he wrote in 1974 proved prophetic. And that's why it haunted him for so long, because he knew that it was wrong and that it would wind up in pain and failure, which is what ultimately happened.
Right. And, of course, we're talking about, in a sense, some sort of wrongdoing, some offense that sort of falls through the cracks. And it's not that nobody cares, but sometimes it's somebody cares, but they don't quite know how to most effectively go after the problem, or it is a problem that is brought to someone's attention but not fully understood, or for whatever reason. And we hear about that all the time with maybe a foster child in an abusive foster home. But there is something about the scope of this when we're talking about all of these men and the terrible mm-hmm. conditions in which they're living that sort of magnify the problem. By the way, say just a quick word about this structure in which they lived. Part of what made it, in a sense, very ironic, what this building had once been and the little traces of that past life that was still evident in this, what ended up being a place of terrible deprivation and squalor.
Well, they were living in an old schoolhouse, and the schoolhouse had been built in around 1911, and it was the gem in the crown that was Adelissa at the time. At the time it was built, Adelissa was a prospering farm town, and so it represented where everybody went to school. So there's so many memories locally about this building. This is where people had their wedding receptions. This is where people had their school plays. This is where people graduated. This is where funeral receptions were held at times. And so the building really was kind of a repository of all the town's memories. And then as the demographics changed and fewer students were going to the school and they regionalized the school system, then the building, you know, sat vacant for a few years before the men, before Henry's Turkey Service moved into the building. So the building had a lot of memories there. And what happened was, as the years went by, the building declined. It fell into disrepair. T.H. Johnson struggled with alcohol. There wasn't the same vigilance that was being kept in monitoring the men's care. And so cockroaches became infested in the building, and the windows got boarded up, and there are leaks in the ceilings. And at the same time, the men are being pushed to work harder and harder at the assembly plant because they have to hit numbers, okay? And they're also not being paid the same as their non-disabled colleagues, no matter how well they are working and no matter how efficiently they're doing their work along the assembly line. So they're being exploited financially. They're being pushed, and they're coming home to what is a squalid environment. And one of the sad aspects of what these men were going through was they would work as hard as they could at the turkey plant, a very difficult job, but their supervisors, who were ill-equipped to handle men with or people with disability, would punish them. They would not be allowed to get out of the van when the van pulled up at a mini-mart so that some of the men could get a beef jerky or get a Mountain Dew or what have you. They might say, Dan, you didn't work hard enough. You can't get out of the van. And so we have to think about how embarrassing and mortifying that must have been for Dan, who is a grown man who has just put in a hard day's work at the assembly line. He's now being told he didn't work hard enough. And this really, really upset the men. So the model is declining as the years go by. T.H. Johnson dies, And now the men are being called names. They're being kicked in the rear end. They're being slapped upside the head. It's not a good situation. That's what was happening by 2009 when the operation was exposed for what it was.
Hmm. So you talk about that event of discovery, the sort of more modern-day social worker who set some of this in motion, and you sort of trace what develops from there. One of the things I so appreciate is that you also share with us the stories of these men. To whatever extent you can uncover the details of the circumstances in which they left their own homes and were placed in this school down in Texas and ultimately made the trip to Iowa, and for many of them where they are now. We get this sense that you developed quite a powerful connection with them. You've already talked about how trustworthy they were in a sense, giving testimony to what had occurred and what they had suffered. Beyond that, what has your connection been, your relationship been with these men?
Well, I wrote a story about this case for the New York Times, and after the story appeared, I kept in touch with the men. I kept revisiting them and seeing how they were doing, partly because I was writing the book and partly because, you know, they had become a part of me. And one of the men wrote to me and said, "Thank you so much for writing the story, but could you help me find my parents? Their names were Tex Vaughn and Marie Allen, and I had no idea. Well, what am I going to do? How am I going to find these parents of this man named Raymond Vaughn, for example?" And you know, it wasn't that hard. So here's a man; he's in his 60s. He has no idea whatever happened to his parents because he hasn't seen them since he was a little boy. And all I did was do a little Googling around on the internet. And fairly quickly, I was able to find Raymond Vaughn's parents, or at least whatever became of them. And Raymond knew nothing about his parents, yet I was able to tell him that his parents were carnival performers. His father was a tattoo artist, and his mother, in fact, was a snake charmer. And, you know, they didn't have the emotional wherewithal to take care of Raymond, and along the way, they had given him up to a foster family and then kind of disappeared. But I was able, through doing this research, to connect Raymond with a niece. And so here's Raymond many, many years later. Now the Henry's Turkey Service operation is shut down. He's living in a residence with several other men. And the phone rings, and it's for him. And he picks it up, and it's his niece, and it says, "Uncle Ray, this is your niece." And he began to cry. And so his niece and he have a very close relationship now, and he spends holidays with her up in Wisconsin. And so that's the kind of thing I was able to do at one point for one of the men, at least.
Mm-hmm. It's a fascinating story. And in some ways, as much as it is disturbing and heartbreaking, it is an inspiring story as well. You've told it beautifully. The book is called The Boys in the Bunkhouse, Servitude and Salvation in the Heartland, published by HarperCollins. And the book, by the way, includes very interesting photographs in which we see the faces of many of these men discussed at length in this riveting book. And the author, Dan Barry. Dan Barry, congratulations on a fine book, on telling this important story so very, very well. And thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg, very much.
The time is 8:49, and you're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTDHD, your gateway to public radio. Part two of today's program is coming up in just a moment. And it's certainly exciting to have the opportunity to speak for the next few minutes with best-selling author Peter Laranjus. He is a prolific author and wildly successful, particularly with a series of books called Seven Wonders. And the fifth and final in that series, The Legend of the Rift, has just come out. And this is a series of books intended for young readers, but people of all ages have been gobbling up the books of this Seven Wonders series. And it's very, very exciting to be able to speak with Peter Laranjus about this series of books and everything else that he has created through his very, very busy life and career. Peter Laranjus, we welcome you to the morning show.
Oh, thanks, Greg. You're too kind. I'm happy to talk to you. And I got to say, I love Milwaukee, and I'm going to be there in a couple of weeks, and I can't wait.
Excellent. So how does somebody who studied biochemistry in college and spent a lot of time on the stage as an actor end up being such a prolific and successful author? How does all of this fit together for you?
Well, all the other stuff was a detour for this, I think. I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, even when I was a little boy. But, you know, as you grow up, you face reality. You know, you come up with all these truisms, and one of the truisms is, you know, you can't make a living as a writer. It's you know, only a fraction of 1% actually do that. So I kind of intimidated myself out of trying to do that, and I kind of went into other things. I loved the sciences. Majored in biochemistry, but I never wanted to be a doctor, and I never really wanted to do research, so it wasn't really a place for me, but I loved studying that stuff. I toyed with the idea of going to law school. I even got into law school, and I said to myself, okay, Peter, you're in, right? Give yourself a year. Defer your enrollment and take a year and try to do something that you really love to do, and you have something in your back pocket in case you fail, right? So I always wanted to be a performer, and I always wanted to be a writer. So I started with the performing thing first, and within 1 year, I got into a Broadway show, and I figured, okay, I'm not going to go to law school, you know, and that was that. And as part of my journey as an actor, I ended up at a theater in Milwaukee, as a matter of fact. Two summers, I was in a theater that no longer exists called the Milwaukee Melody Top. I did about 8, maybe more, musical theater, and had a great time spending summers there. And then eventually, in between my acting jobs, I went back to the thing I always wanted to do, which was writing. And before long, I had to make a choice. I was married. I wanted to have a family. And I thought, well, you know, I could keep trying to be an actor and, you know, leaving home and, getting rejected all the time, or I could go into writing. And that was really starting to become so satisfying, and I really felt that that's the basket I wanted to put my eggs in, and I haven't looked back ever since.
Mm-hmm. This series called Seven Wonders has, of course, been spectacularly successful. I wonder if you could just say a word, first of all, about what you think about when you write with younger readers in mind. What is it that you set about doing that allows you to click with younger readers so well?
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing. I still remember so vividly what it was like to be that age and the kinds of things that I thought about. And that always stayed alive inside of me. I don't know why. You know, we're all a little bit different that way. But the idea that you're at a point in your life where, you know, even the most basic questions, what's right, what's wrong, you know, what happened when a friend who you really, really like betrays you? Why does that happen? You know, why does somebody have to move away after you've become great friends? All of the things that... All those concerns stayed with me. Plus, I love action adventure. I used to love to read that kind of stuff. And one day when I was, 10 years old, I was reading a story by Jack London called To Build a Fire. It was a 90-degree day. We didn't have air conditioning. And I was reading this book, and it took place in the far north, a man surviving in the snow with his dog. And all of a sudden, I felt myself shivering with the cold, and it was 90 degrees outside. And I thought, wow, I want to do this. I want to be able to move people physically just by using words. If I could do that, that would be the most awesome thing in the world. It took a long time to get there, but I really felt connected to those kinds of stories that I loved when I was a kid.
Hmm. You have created a universe in which magic coexists with just everyday life. I mean, magic in a world of cell phones. And of course, at the heart of this story are young people who are working to try to, in a sense, save the planet. the way that things have gone dangerously awry. Just talk for a moment about the world itself that we find in Seven Wonders and the care with which you created it.
Oh, right. Well, at the very beginning of the story, you've got four kids who are finding themselves on an island in the middle of nowhere. They don't know how they got there. They don't know why they're there. All they know is that there are all these people walking around in lab coats. Well, of course, they're subjects of a study. It turns out that they are all descended from a prince who escaped the sinking of the continent of Atlantis centuries ago, right? And this prince had a gene that they've inherited now. What this gene does is it takes whatever you're already good at and turns it into a superpower. So if you're a good athlete, you're, you know, sinking jump shots from 50 yards. If you're really good at computers, you can hack into anything. That's the power of this gene. But it's got a dark side. Anybody who's ever had this characteristic has never lived past the age of 14. Well, all these kids are 13 years old. They've got 1 year. And on this island, they've found a cure. Now, if these kids can go and find seven magical objects that were taken from Atlantis before it sank by this prince and hidden in the seven wonders of the ancient world, which were built for that purpose, and they bring these objects back to this island, they will be cured, and they'll live great, long, awesome lives. And also, as it turns out, they will save the world. Well, how do they do that? You know, of the seven wonders of the ancient world, six of them no longer exist, right? Just the pyramids of Egypt. Those are the only ones. So how do you bring back to life these six ancient structures in order to bring yourself back to life? And how do you do it when the personalities of these four kids are so different? Our hero, Jack, he's an ordinary kid. He doesn't know what his special talent is. He doesn't know what this gene is going to do to him. He doesn't have any special talent. Well, he has to find out what that talent is. And these kids have to do this as a team, and it's an impossible task, and there's magic, and there's fantasy and action and adventure. And by the end of book four, the whole thing has completely fallen apart. Two of the objects are destroyed. The island is about to be destroyed itself. And there's just no way by the end of book four that this thing is ever going to happen. And that's kind of the task I set for myself for the last book, book five. And that's actually what's bringing me out on tour. The book comes out tomorrow, the 8th, and I get to go to 10 different cities or 11 different cities and talk to kids and find out what they really think.
And, of course, one of the things that's especially delicious about the way you've written this story is that you have brothers and sisters squabbling and children and their complicated relationships with their parents and so on. I mean,
right.
You've really tried to cast these young people in some ways as heroic figures and yet as very real and authentic as well.
Well, that's what I try to do, because if you write series where each of the characters have kind of impossible abilities, right, you know, you run the risk of being too cartoony. And what I think brings literature to life, and what I really love reading, is characters who feel like people you can meet in the street. So yeah, that for me was one of my great goals, was to make characters that the kids could identify with.
The Legend of the Rift is the fifth and final book in the Seven Wonders series by Peter Larangis. Peter Larangis, congratulations on your spectacular success, and thank you for joining me today on The Morning Show. Best wishes to you, and happy writing.
Thanks, Greg. Pleasure to be here.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, it is Nan Calvert's monthly visit to The Morning Show, and she will help lead a conversation about one of the most fascinating insects around us, the dragonfly and the damselfly. And on Friday, we'll be